Welcome to Star Trek Comic Book Review. Our several-year mission will be to boldly go where no podcast has gone before. We will be reviewing every Star Trek comic book ever published. These stories have been released by Gold Key, Marvel, DC, Malibu, Wildstorm, Tokyo Press, IDW, and others. Star Trek and all that the Star Trek universe contains is copyrighted by CBS Studios, Inc.
Hello and welcome to Star Trek Comic Book Review with Donovan again. Episode number 437, recorded November 11th, 2024. Happy Veterans Day.
So today we're just doing one comic that just happens to have eight little stories in it called Star Trek 500.
Right. So 500th issue of IDW Star Trek?
Yep.
Is that it? That's what it's supposed to be? It's a celebration of all the issues that came before, I guess.
Yeah, and it just seems like it was just the other day that they had 400. So they are pumping them out fast.
And so Dayton Ward, who wrote the thing at the end, he said that was 2 years ago. It doesn't seem like 2 years ago.
Yeah, no, I went back and looked. It came out in 2022. That is two years ago.
There you go. He is right. Okay.
So
the eighth thing is a nice little write-up by Dayton Ward.
Right.
So a Star Trek novelist and other novels. So nice to hear from him.
So for Star Trek 400, we had a bunch of little short stories based in different continuities. I don't remember Enterprise getting a story, which it also doesn't get a story here. But
it's never going to get a story.
But here we at least did get here we didn't even get a Kelvin story, which kind of made me sad because that was one of the highlights of 400 is that there was that little short Scotty story set in the Kelvin universe. But we didn't even get that here. There's too much other new franchises to cover.
Yeah, they were really focusing on the newer TV ones with a few other things thrown in for spice. But
we got Taz, and then we get the comic, and then there's like a comic book tie-in. Mm-hmm. But aside from that, all the others are just the new series. I guess Deep Space Nine had one, so I guess there's two legacies, one comic book crossover, and then the new stuff.
Yeah, but the Deep Space Nine one is definitely a tie-in to a mini-series that IDW did recently. So,
your favorites, too.
One of my favorites. If I could think of all the different comic book mini-series to have, that's the number one that we need to revisit again. Not Dog of War.
Well,
again, I love dogs, but I just don't get that series.
Anyway. And I don't get this little short story because it doesn't really make sense. But it's unfortunately not the first one. So we'll get three before we get to there.
Right. And at least the good thing about the Dog of War continuation story playing baseball is it's only 2 pages long.
Yeah.
Yay.
All right. Well, should we jump into it?
Okay. So we got 10 covers on this one. That's a lot of covers. Cover A features a standard colorful background with a title text saying Star Trek 500. In the foreground are 10 famous characters, including Picard, Kirk, Sisko, Janeway, Shaw, Worf, Emperor Giorgio, Pike, Sulu, and Burnham. And the art's by Jolie Jones. Cover B is a wide cover. I guess this just wraps around to the back of the book, I guess. It's wide. It's a two-pager. So it has a space background with the Theseus, Defiant, Enterprise refit, and Stargazer ships to the right, over with the title, which says Star Trek 500. And then they got too many Star Trek characters on this. I mean, they got a lot. And there's too many of them for me to list them all, so I'm not going to try. But there are many, and Sisko and Worf are prominent. But I got to mention Kirk's, or rather Picard with hair. That's kind of funny. Anywho, art by Jake Bartok. It's a good cover. I like it.
And it's cool. It's cool to see the Boimler in his live action form.
Oh, yes. That's a good point. That's a very good point.
And Laddie,
so we see Mariner. Oh, Laddie. Yeah. So we see Mariner and Boimler in their real, the real actors. Okay. Cover C features a background with the numbers 500 in huge stone. So that's like, takes up a lot of the background. And then we've got lots of various characters from the different IDW comics, like Captain Sisko in his uniform from Star Trek 2022, ongoing series. Worf in his black ninja uniform from the Defiant ongoing series. General Uhura in her green uniform, so an alternate Uhura, and holding her helmet from the Star Trek The Motion Picture Echoes miniseries. Ro Laren from the Defiant ongoing series. Mariner from Lower Decks, who popped up in a miniseries recently. Jake Anagh from Star Trek Sons. And of course, out in front is the dog of war himself, Lottie. And of course, this is a nice painting thing by J.K. Woodward. Retailer incentive cover A presents another wide cover drawn in Lower Deck style that I assume takes up the front and back of the book, like the other one. It presents Q as the ultimate Star Trek fan holding his comic book while sitting on his Inquisitor's throne with the robes and everything from the first TNG episode. To his left is a comic book rack holding IDW Star Trek comics, a comic book box that is in front of the rack that I assume is holding a bunch of Star Trek comic books. And to the left is a floor-standing curio cabinet with six shelves holding approximately 42 Star Trek character dolls. Or are they real? Retailer incentive cover B presents a traditional drawing of Kirk and Spock and McCoy's heads in sort of a transporter effect in the upper half, with the Enterprise forward-facing towards the reader in the lower half. And that's by Alex Ross. The sixth one is a retailer incentive cover C that just presents the black and white version of retailer incentive cover B, again by Alex Ross. The seventh is a retailer incentive cover that presents Picard, Chris Pine Kirk, and Seven of Nine standing in the foreground. In the background is a collection of photographs that have Quark, Q, Spock, Sulu, Dr. Crusher, Worf, Giorgio, and Uhura, I think. And it's a nice one. And at least you get Chris Pine Kirk somehow in this. Retailer exclusive cover presents a television in the lower left corner with a rainbow coming out of it that swerves up and to the right. And at the end of the rainbow, of course, is the Enterprise from the motion picture, the refit, nice. Along the rainbow is a TOS communicator, a TOS phaser, Spock, the Enterprise D, Geordi, Savick, and Kirk in a TOS spacesuit. Hanging out on its own in the upper left-hand corner is a Klingon bird of prey, and the text says Star Trek 500 is in the lower right across from the TV, and the art's by Bill Galvin. Another retailer exclusive cover presents a simplistic drawing of a Gorn holding an unconscious Uhura on a planetary surface with mountains and planets in the background. Kirk is holding a phaser and Spock, and they're to the rescue. And that's by Dan Parent. And then the final cover is kind of blah. It's called a retailer exclusive logo cover, which simply has the Star Trek text. I think that's TOS for font on a Starfield background. And this one doesn't really have a credit. That's it. 10. It's a lot. What do you think? Any comments on the covers? You made one.
I liked seeing Savick. That's the Christy Alley Savick, which I always liked.
Cool. Yep.
And then Alex Ross's cover has the gold key style to it, which I really liked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think that one thing with the Gorn holding Uhura is maybe one of the weaker ones, but there are some good ones here.
Yeah, that Gorn one is weird. It's almost, very cartoony.
It's almost childish.
But it's a style.
Yeah, yeah, it's fine. So I'll be doing the first four, and Donovan will be doing the next four. So I am going to launch into the first one, which is titled, I Knew You Were Going to Be Tribble When You Walked In. Actually, it's I Knew You Were Tribble When You Walked In. And this is written by Jordan Blum and Patton Oswalt. Yes, the Patton Oswalt, the actor and writer and other things. Artist, Vernon Smith. Colorist, Charlie Kirchhoff. Letterer, Jody Troutman. Oh, and let me also mention that overall, all the books, we've got a design and production by Anil Yataki, group editor Heather Antos, editorial assists Cassandra Jones, and the published date is September 2024. Okay. Okay. Darkness, and then lights, and then hunger. I am in a big metal container being presented to two large things, one dark and one light. Before long, I am in a new big metal container, and I am able to feed and multiply. There are many large things that like to pet and feed me, and my progeny, of which there are now many. Suddenly, my heart stops when I see my blonde savior in a green shirt. He seems to be the only one who is in a green top. I sing my siren song when he picks me up to examine me. My cries of passion go unheeded as my paragon and his blue companion leave the room. I enjoy my time in this new large metal thing as I transition through my many, many progeny in search of my chiseled, torrid demigod. I enter the body of one of my offspring and find myself in a new large metal box, the large things call the bridge. I am on a soft black thing in the center of the big box, but elevated when suddenly the gods have truly smiled upon me as my golden god arrives and plants his luscious lumps upon me. First contact! I find a place full of food that I consume and continue to multiply so I can ensure I can be wherever my love is in either big metal box. I can feel part of me die before their time. What was in that food? I see some new large things with dark hairy faces speaking to one of the big things. They conspire against my beloved. He must be warned, and later I do just that. While in my beloved's hands, I come close to the conspirators, and I scream with all my might at them. The enemies are defeated, and my beloved finally sees me. Things go dark again, and then suddenly light. I am in a third big new metal box, but it's not like the others. In this new harsh guttural place, I send out waves of warmth and hope to another. When I'm about to give up, a large dark thing approaches and picks me up. This one is a dark-featured Adonis. The pain of losing my golden love abates. And can it be a new love is birthed? The end. And of course, it's a tribble the whole time.
Well, that was an interesting synopsis, Ken. You never once mentioned that it was tribble.
No, you got to figure that out.
If you had not read it, you would be very confused as to what Kirk's sitting on.
Oh. Hold on. You know from what's happening here that there are clues all over the place. Who the narrator is.
Yeah.
And plus, if you ever watch Trouble with Tribbles, you'd have an idea about some of the beats that happened. But yeah. I could have ruined it for everybody and said up front that I was a tribble. But no, I didn't. I left it to them to figure it out.
Gotcha. Well, if you're reading the comic book,
you guys can let us know yes or no. Well, yeah, of course the comic book does. But I had the opportunity of, you know, seeing if people could figure it out themselves. Anyway.
There you go.
So what did you think? Did you like this one?
Not at first. At first, I thought it was just another, because I know there at least one other comic book, maybe more, but at least one, got in that it was spoke. The protagonist was a shrivel, and that was the point of view that you were given as the reader.
Right.
And yeah, so this is just another one of those.
One of Alien Spotlights was a tribble issue.
Ooh, yeah, that's it. Good memory. That's it. So it was just like, oh my God, they're doing this again. And it's like, oh my God, this, I have never heard such flowery, poetic dialogue from a tribble's mind. What do you think?
Right. I think I liked the Alien Spotlight Tribbles one better. When all they said was feed.
Well,
I mean, and then when did Tribbles get a hive mind where one Tribble could jump into the mind of other Tribbles? That was all
exactly.
Like new
and can jump bodies. Yeah, that's
completely right. And a little confusing.
It was confusing, you know. but you figured out pretty quick. I mean, it basically was all told from one Tribble's point of view. And it is the Tribble, the original one, that was sold to O'Hara and Chekhov.
Right.
So that was, I mean, you know, the Tribble, not like he's got legs. So
right.
How else is he going to get around?
Right. Yeah. So I thought it was kind of cool how they did that for that part. You know, just that way we can have him or have her, whatever it is, the Tribble. The Tribble's consciousness, our narrator in all these different situations.
Right.
But it also was just like, there was so many parts that were like odd, like when Sisko showed up and what does the Tribble say? Like, I think my God's here or something like that.
Yeah. He thought it was Kirk.
Oh, because of the
I think that's what I got out of it because of the uniform. Although Kirk was wearing the green uniform.
Right.
And Sisko was wearing the tan. Yeah. And look at the head.
I see the bald head. my chiseled, torsoed demigod. So then I'm like, oh, so the Tribble knows that he's a demigod, that he's half prophet. So then I'm like,
oh, but he was calling Kirk, you know, the blonde Adonis. Good point about referring to Sisko as a demigod, but I thought that was within the context of him with his flowery love speech about Kirk. That's what I thought it was.
I don't think anybody would confuse Kirk with
Sisko. No, I agree. I agree, but I thought that's what they were trying to get across, but maybe not.
Maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, so it's Jazia and Sisko. They make a brief little one panel guest starring thing.
Yeah, from the Trials and Tribulations episode.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I was confused on that part, on if he was trying to make a reference that the Tribbles know about his deity lineage. And then the other part was, is that when they get left on K7 and the Klingon ship, the Tribble has like this fantasy of Kirk kissing on all these alien women.
Yeah, let's talk about that, shall we?
And Gorn. I was just like, where is this coming from?
What? Exactly. I completely agree. So this is like, full page drawing, I think. And so this is after he's beamed onto the Klingon ship, but before he meets his new swarthy, dark Adonis. And what was he saying crap about? Like, ooh, we want to be parts of families, and now what? They're part of the Enterprise crew family?
Right. So, and he knows, and it somehow will know that all these events are going to happen?
Exactly.
In the future? I don't know. I did not like it.
No, but and of course, Kirk with the Gorn at the bottom, that was a joke.
Right. That so the Tribble was mistaken that squeeze for a hug or something. Like, oh, that could have been me.
What's the deal about Kirk and MRS? I mean, they never had anything going, did they?
No.
So what's that about?
No clue.
So the Uhura kiss, okay, fine. And then that, whatever that Amazon woman.
Yeah.
Yeah, so she was the Gamesters of Triskelion. So that makes sense. That was an episode. Who is in the red shirt with that blonde woman? Is that supposed to be Kirk?
I think it's supposed to be Kirk, yeah.
Okay, because I was looking at it going, is that Scotty? It's like, or no, the hair looks kind of blonde. So is that supposed to be Carol Marcus? I mean, I don't know who the blonde lady is. That's not.
Yeah, I don't either. It would make sense if it was Carol Marcus, because that he was in engineering at one point.
Yep. When he was on the Farragut or someplace.
Right, somewhere.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It was fun because that page drawing was fun because it was like a Where's Waldo kind of thing. And we'll see another thing like this later in this book. But I mean, it didn't make a lot of sense to me either. But it's kind of fun.
Right. I mean, it would make sense if maybe there was still one more Tribble on the ship or something like that. Uh-huh. And because it's now a hive mind, it's like beaming in this information into the mother Tribble. Mm-hmm. But there is no Tribbles on the ship, so right. That can't be it.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else?
I just wanted to mention that I like Patton Oswalt a lot. The first time I remember seeing him was on a movie called Young Adult. Hmm. And he was really good in that role. I had never, with that Kevin, that comedy show, that situation comedy with Kevin, Paul Blart, Mall Cop, that guy.
King of Queens?
Kevin James. Kevin. Yeah. Yeah, there you go. King of Queens. That's it. So I know he was on there as some supporting character or something further in the back, but I never watched that show, so I never had no idea. Right. So I thought he was really good in Young Adult. I thought he was his voice. He did a great job in Ratatouille. And I loved what he did with the Star Wars filibuster thing on Parks and Rec.
Yeah, that's pretty funny.
But I saw a stand-up routine he did. Like he did a stand-up comic special. And it's like, I only watched like the first 10 minutes because I didn't find it good. And yeah, it was
it's probably the one that he did after his wife died. And after he got remarried, I saw that one too, and I didn't like that one. But his earlier stuff I did like, so I don't know if his comedy changed.
Anywho, I'm a big fan of him, but not that one stand-up comedy thing, so I wasn't sure how good this was going to be. And it's like, it was fine. It was fine. Sure. I mean, you can see some of the dialogue in here. Especially the flowery, poetic, his lumps, whatever, coming out of Patton Oswalt's pen.
Right, sure.
Who knows?
Yeah. And as far as Patton Oswalt goes, it is kind of cool that he's been in Ghostbusters. He was in the last Ghostbusters movie, but he was also in one of the Ghostbusters video games where he plays the ghost that's actually in the little logo. there's a video game and he's the voice of that ghost, and he's kind of the one that's giving you the tutorial on how to use everything and things like that. So and then I thought that was funny that he was in the video game and then later he got to be in the movie itself. but back to the book itself, one of the things I didn't really like is the retconning. The Tribbles don't have this inherent hate for Klingons, which has been the thing for all of Star Trek.
Is that we interpreted? Could we have misinterpreted that?
I mean, there's been enough expanded media from their point of view to know that that's what it was from the Great Tribble Wars and all that stuff.
Great Tribble Wars? What the hell is that?
You don't remember the Alien Spotlight? Yeah. It was in the Alien Spotlight.
Oh, so that one that was, it was a Great Tribble War?
Okay. Well, they talked about it. Yeah, that's why as a species they hate the Klingons so much. Which is why when they hold the Tribble to that modified Klingon, it squeaked. Whereas here they're now retconning it, saying that he's doing it because he loves Kirk so much. He's trying to let him know.
Well, yeah, he's trying to let them know that he is one of his enemies.
Right.
So I'm fine with that. It's like if you didn't have that other comic book out there, and all you had to go on is what we saw in video, the Taz TV show and other ones that revisited the topic. It's like you could completely be misinterpreting.
Yeah, I think even in Trials and Tribulations, they talk about how the Tribbles hate the Klingons, and that's...
Well, oh, my God. So how does anybody know what's inside of a Tribble's head? I mean, come on. They don't talk. They don't write things out. The Klingon War, that's why.
Tribble.
I'm just saying, I just have two words for you. Tribble War. No, Fine. I thought it was kind of clever. Because like we could have had it wrong the whole time. Anyway, whatever.
All right.
You ready? Ooh, let me just one more thing for Patton Oswalt. I loved him in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. I love that character. He was. He was.
Yeah, he was.
Because you didn't know what the guy with the lanyard. Mm-hmm. It's like that was so funny. It was so funny.
Yeah, he's a funny guy.
And then you didn't know what the deal was with him. And then you saw that there was a second one of them. And then you're thinking, oh, is he a robot? Is he a clone? And it's like, oh, no, that's just my twin brother. We both work in the same place. It's like, oh, that's funny. I liked it. All right, moving on. Okay, so number two, Yesterday's Shadow. Lieutenant La'an is walking through an Enterprise corridor to an appointment, thinking about her adventure with Jim Kirk that ended with his death. She arrives in a conference room where she begins speaking with Lieutenant Sam Kirk, the ship's anthropologist. She wants to ask a few questions about Sam's brother, likely for personal reasons, but Sam replies, assuming Starfleet is asking him questions because they are evaluating Jim for yet another big promotion. She tries to correct his misinterpretation and suggests a change of venue to the ship's lounge. In the lounge, their discussion is less formal, and they both talk about biases and expectations that come with their family names. Sam talks about how his baby brother has achieved much and shows him up on a regular basis. La'an thinks he does not know the half of the pain she has suffered with the surname Noonien Singh. As the discussion draws to a close, La'an seems to feel a little less bad over the loss of her alternate dimension, Jim Kirk. In closing, La'an does disclose a rumor going around about someone receiving a record-breaking promotion. Sam spits out his drink in mid-gulp. The end.
So this story was written by Jody Hauser.
Is that familiar name?
Yeah, so she writes a lot of Star Wars, Doctor Who. She's even written some Halo and Stranger Things and things like that, comic books. So so it's kind of cool. For Star Trek, she's written a few other things, but I mainly know her from Star Wars and Doctor Who stuff. So anyways, it's kind of cool to see her here in a short story.
Yeah. So how'd you like the story?
It just drives home one of the things that I have a problem with. The character is that everybody seems to know who Noonien Singh is when Kirk seems surprised in Space Seed.
Sure.
Spock
has to look him up.
Yeah, Spock has to look him up. And I'm like, Spock, you worked with his great-great-great-granddaughter. You probably know who he is. Wouldn't have to look him up. And she acts like everybody knows who her parents are or her lineage is.
Yes.
So I didn't like that part, but I don't like that part in the main show either.
Yeah.
But as far as the story itself, her having a conversation with Sam and him kind of being underneath Kirk's shadow and her being under the shadow, I liked it. It was all right.
Yeah, it was okay, but it's like I could have lived my life without reading this story. It didn't really give me a lot. I mean, personally, I like a lot on character, but they spent an amazing amount of panel space just rehashing that episode of Strange New Worlds. Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, or whatever the name of it was.
Yeah, something like that.
Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow. That was the name of it. So, I mean, they spent a lot of time just rehashing it. It's like, okay, I saw it. I don't know that I need to have it rehashed here, but I mean, if people didn't see that episode, what would be the point of this whole thing? I mean, what is the point of her getting together with Sam anyway? I mean, what's she trying to get out of this conversation?
Oh, she just wants to know.
Want to know more about her? Like.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, but it's not. Yeah. Yeah. So she's trying to find a way to work through her grief, I guess. But
yeah. Right.
I didn't see much point to it, quite frankly, but
yeah, but it's maybe better than some of these other ones that we're about to get into.
Oh, I agree. I think the artwork is nice. Everybody
beautiful.
Looks like the actors.
Yep.
It's nice. Okay.
Yep.
Anything else?
Nope. I'm good.
Okay. Speaking of one of those that isn't that good. The Unexpected Mentor is the next one. So Stephanie Williams wrote it, and Tench did the artwork, and the coloring is by J.P. Jordan. Okay, so I totally got that wrong on my notes. Okay. Captain Burnham and a rescue team from Discovery are in the city of Anthonia on the planet Nestra. The city has been devastated by tectonic activity that made many buildings dangerous and about to collapse. Burnham and her team are getting survivors to shuttles when she hears a call for help. A mother is injured and just leaving a building, but her daughter Lyra is still inside. Burnham turns the mother over to medical personnel while she goes into the building heroically to find Lyra and get her out of there. She finally finds the little girl in a closet holding onto her Daggett toy with all her might. Burnham is able to talk Lyra out of her fear-induced paralysis, saying it's okay to be fearful as long as you are still able to work past it and do what must be done. That is the definition of bravery. An aftershock hits, blocking the way Burnham came in, so they need to find a different way out. After venturing out and looking for a new way, Lyra spots an opening high up near the ceiling. They make their way up and out of the building into the light. They walk in the crowds until Lyra spots her mother and runs to her. Mom waves back at Burnham with her precious bundle of joy back in her arms. Beaming with pride and joy, Lyra tells her mother that Captain Burnham made her an honorary member of Starfleet. The end.
So you said a Daggett toy. I wanted to look that up.
Yeah.
It does not look like a Daggett.
No, it does not look like a Daggett, but I just felt like saying it.
It's a penguin.
It's a big stuffed penguin, but I wanted to say Daggett. And of course, what's a Daggett from?
Battlestar Galactica. Classics.
Damn right. And what is it supposed to be, kind of, sort of?
A dog, right?
Well, yeah, it's supposed to be a dog, but it kind of looks like a little bit like a bear or maybe a little bit like a monkey. I don't know what the heck it's looking like, but yeah, it's supposed to be a robot pet.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So before we started recording, you pointed out a few inconsistencies with time frame and electronics. You want to mention those real quick because they were good observations.
Yeah. So looking at the uniform that Burnham has on, it looks like it's like 900 years in the future. So it's not the pre-Kirk time or pre-Taws time period. It's actually like 1,000 years in the future. And in several panels, it shows her actually talking to the ship or to somebody on a flip communicator. So that's more like in the old, 22nd century or whatever, the pre-Taws time frame communicator. So I thought that was dang odd since all that's built into the badge. And then also there's a part where she's using a tricorder. And the tricorder looks like it's the thing from the show before they went 900 years in the future. So it was like inconsistencies.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. So. And at first, when I first started reading it, I thought this was set even further in the future because it looked like Burnham had the gray hair she does in the final episode of Discovery, you know, when it shows her older. So right. I was thinking, oh, this is set way in the future, right? When she's, you know, about to retire or whatever. Mm. And then reading it, it's like, no, I think this is supposed to be set like during season four or before season four.
Right.
But her hair does look a little gray. I don't know if it's just the
lighting,
draw
coloring.
Yeah.
Cause if you look at her face, especially in the final panel, it's very idealized and she looks quite young.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I completely agree. Her hair does not look black.
Right. And she did, you know, in that last episode, she's gray haired. I mean, it's still the same mm-hmm. actress wearing makeup. So it's like she quote unquote looked old, but she didn't. But yeah, so it's just like, I really thought that's what we were going to get a story set in that time frame, but I don't think mm-hmm. it is.
Yeah.
But anyways, yeah, it was really just, we need your help. Don't be scared. And then she ends mm-hmm. up finding the way out.
Right.
It's kind of short and simple.
Yeah. Short and quick. It's fine. She has a little interaction with the kid. Great. So at the end, you know, she's got a comm badge on, or what appears to be a comm badge. So mm-hmm. what does Burnham just walk around with dummy comm badges to give out to kids like airline pilots in the 60s?
No, I think that's a legit
one. Or is that a real one?
Yeah, it's the one she was wearing. Yeah.
Now, okay, so Deathly Comm badges are not only comm badges, but they also seem to have tricorder kind of abilities. And correct me if I'm wrong or not, don't some of those suckers have like transporter capabilities?
In the new ones, yeah. In the new Discovery ones. Time frame, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, in the 1,000 years in the future, 900, yeah, whatever.
That's a lot of tech she just gave that little girl.
Exactly. That's exactly my point.
Yeah. Yeah, we're going to be monitoring you from now on. We can beam you out at any time. You'll never have privacy again.
Yeah, if you look close on that badge, it says Facebook.
Yeah. Oh.
And my last comment on this one is the shuttles they're using look very odd. At least are they shuttles? I don't know. Whatever space vehicles they're using, I don't know if I've ever seen those before in Star Trek.
They kind of look like Defiance with rocks on top of them.
Yeah, what's the rocks doing on top of them? I don't get that.
Yeah, I don't either. That's just how they design their ships, these blue people.
Yeah, I don't know. Odd. Okay, that's it.
All right, your last one. Here we go.
Now, this is a short one. The Latinum Glove. Yay, Latinum Glove. Okay, so this one is written by Mike Chen, drawn by Angel Hernandez, colored by Nick Filardi. And it's only two pages. Quark enters one of his holo suites to find Rom, Ezri Dax, and Captain Sisko playing baseball. Annoyed, Quark chastises Rom. The hollow suites are supposed to be for the customers. And he comments that Laddie is out there playing in the outfield. Ezri cuts in, explaining that Captain Sisko says they need to gear up for the rematch with Solok's Vulcan team. Sisko knocks a mighty hit out into the outfield. Rom explains that Laddie is taking his place in the right field. Quark thinks for a moment and states that Laddie may be able to catch, but he can't throw. Laddie makes a great defensive catch, just as he's saying that. Rom replies, at least you can catch. I can't throw or catch, so Laddie's already better than me. Da-dum-dum. The end.
Yeah, this was just a two-page setup for a joke.
Yes, exactly. That is exactly what it is. The dog looks cute. All right.
Yeah, but what about all the other dogs and in the bleachers?
Good, excellent questions. there are a few questions here. So, yeah, what's the deal? I don't know. I don't know what the dogs. I mean,
I'm assuming they're holographic dogs, right?
They're holographic. They have to be holographic dogs. And what? They're part of the team now? Or
I don't know.
I mean, they're in uniforms.
They're wearing uniforms and hats and everything, just exactly. Like Laddie is. Oh, so stupid.
It's stupid. I like.
Yeah, go ahead.
I like how Gorn is the or not Gorn. Morn is the play-by-play announcer. I think that's great.
Is he?
That I like. Well, yeah, he's in the booth.
Oh, there he is. I see him there in the booth. Okay, wow.
Yeah. Perfect. I do like that, although I don't get the dogs in the bleachers.
Yeah, so remind me, at the end of Dog of War, Laddie ended up staying on the station? Is that where we ended that story?
And then, okay. And then Morn took him.
Oh, that's right. Morn took him on his ship.
Right. Well, he took him, but I had the impression Morn lived in the station.
Mm. Although we'll never see him again, but here we are seeing
probably
him
not.
Again.
Yes. Well, you see him in the comic book. That's right.
Yeah.
In the background.
Mm. All right.
I have one last thing to say. In the first panel, it says that this story takes place after the events of Dog of War. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So the word after apparently is fungible. Because in Dog of War, the miniseries, Jadzia Dax was very much a part of that. And in this, apparently this takes place after Jadzia's dead. And and Ezri's there. So
right. Which fine. Could just be, you know, the next episode.
Well,
the next season, right? So this is a season seven story. That was a season six story.
Okay, but after is a lot after. I mean,
potentially. Yeah.
When they use the word
it's not
after,
immediately after,
you have the impression it was, I don't know, pretty soon after the last one, with given no more context. But then you see Ezri is like, well, this must have been a lot after,
right?
Anyway,
yeah, it wasn't the next day. I did like seeing Ezri because we don't see very many comic books set in that season seven time frame.
No, but, so but it was interesting.
That
choice.
Was my comment. Yeah.
Interesting choice. Okay. That's it for me, right? Yeah.
Yep, unless you have any more on that issue.
I do not.
All right, well then let's move on to the Lower Deck story entitled Go See Cal, written by Magdalene Visago, written by Megan Huang, colored by Charlie Kirchhoff. And again, Lower Deck story. In it, Rutherford and Tendi have created a Soong-type android. The captain has her doubts about having an android, you know, and brings up even past experiences with Badgy and Dracula. The pair assure her that the android is completely above board and that they used only the best parts, omitting that the is a major part of him that came from a Ferengi bootlegger. They call the android Cal, you know, obviously after the California class ship that they're on. And as he's meeting with all the other crew members of the ship, he seems to be only focused on the profitability of the Cerritos. Eventually, Cal gathers enough info, and then he uses a transporter to beam off the whole crew into the pattern buffers. Once that happens, he opens up a communications and he starts a bidding war for the ship. Luckily, Tendi and Rutherford were able to pull off their comm badges before they were also sent to the buffer. During the bidding, Tendi pops out of her hiding place and she bids well over everybody else. And she uses her moniker, Mistress of the Winter Constellations. Cal takes this as a real bid, and while he's distracted, Rutherford is able to tackle him, pull his face off, and then pull a chip from what looks like his eyeball. Now that the android is neutralized and Rutherford has killed yet another one of his cybernetic children, They then go about returning the crew out of the buffers. The end.
Ha, ha, ha. Did you like this one?
It was all right. I mean, it was Lower Decks.
What do you mean?
It's Lower Decks. It didn't take it too seriously.
Yeah. Well. Yeah, there's nothing.
I did have a problem with the pattern buffers able to hold the patterns for every single member of the crew. That seemed a little much.
Safely.
And there was no other crew members that were taking a shower or something and didn't also have their comm badge off just at that time.
Good point.
There's a lot of holes in this story if you really wanted to start picking at it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, plenty of them.
But I liked the Dracula call out because that was just from the comic book.
Yeah. And he saved him. So don't be talking down Dracula.
And that wasn't even like they didn't intentionally create Dracula like they intentionally created
not
Badgie.
At all. Nah, Badgie.
So anyways, what'd you think? Did you like it? Not like it?
There's one thing I didn't like about it, and I always, when I react like this to stories, I kind of wonder, am I a misogynistic person? But whatever. So this is very much up until the very end when Rutherford finally does something. This is very much a Tindy-oriented story. I mean, they're both in it. They're both partners and stuff. But basically, Rutherford is an imbecile. And Tindy pretty much figures out everything. So she's hitting Rutherford in the side when he's stupidly saying, oh, yeah, the binaural compensator we got from Ferengis. She's nudging him saying, a reputable traitor. So it's like, okay, fine, whatever. And then later, when they're, he says, well, maybe we shouldn't have used the Ferengi bootleg compensator. And then she's like shushing him, saying, keep quiet, or we're going to get in trouble. So again, he's advancing a theory that, you know, maybe the Ferengi compensator is what's making Cal act like a profit-driven Ferengi, and she's like shushing him. Shut up, idiot! It's like, oh, okay. And then again, he's trying to get into the door. I mean, he's the engineer, right? I mean, I know at the beginning, Tindy was like somebody that went to help out in the, you know, in the sick bay with, you know, with the cat lady, and and it's like I'm not quite sure what her position is now, but. But he's the engineer. And so she's saying, hurry up. It's been almost an hour. And then Rutherford, I'm doing my best. He's got it locked tight. And then she's saying, oh, let me do it. It's like, oh, my. He's an engineer. What? How do you think you could do this better? Ah.
That's a good point. I mean, last one I'll give you.
And then again, she's the one that knows to get rid of the badges. And like, he's probably worked on the transporter on maintenance. And he's probably knows better than anybody about how the transporters work. Anyway, whatever. And then of course the big thing is, you know, she solves the thing at the end saying she's the mistress of the winter constellation. So that's fine. That's fine. That's who she is. We found out about that in a recent episode. Of Lower Decks. So that's, and maybe they've mentioned that before. So that's fine there. But then at least they let him tackle the robot and pull his chip. So at least he was able to do something.
I thought he was pretty well written as far as being like the TV show, except for that door thing. I'll give you the door thing. But aside from that, I thought he was written pretty well.
I think she was the one that was presented as the one with all the answers. And again, the guy is a knob.
Well, it's
except at the very end.
He didn't want to have to kill his baby again, and he did it.
No, he did do it. So, did you know that Okono's last name is Thaddean? Or her first name is Thaddean? Did we know that?
Okona. Oh, yeah.
So he's one of the guys
mentioned that in that episode that he's in Lower Decks.
The outrageous Okona mentioned his first name? Okay.
In the Lower Decks episode, because they spend a lot of time with him.
Oh, he was in Lower Decks, too? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, he popped up a lot, because he was in, for a while, he was in Prodigy.
Right. Okay. Yeah, he gets around.
Boy, for a one-shot character that really didn't make much of an impression on me in TNG, he sure does pop up a lot.
He was played by the Rocketeer. You gotta watch it.
Yeah, I like the actor.
Yeah.
But he's good. Okay, that's all I have to say.
Nothing else?
Meh.
You don't have a problem with the pattern buffers?
Oh, well, I'm not going to repeat your points. I agree.
I thought maybe you would have a different take on it.
No. Well, I mean, Scotty survived for decades or whatever. Yeah. But
there was two of them, and one of them didn't make it. So, I mean, I always got from that issue that it was like a big deal to keep people in the pattern buffers. And then with Strange New World, it's just like, it's no big deal.
Oh, yeah.
Just stick your daughter in there for months at a time.
That's right. Now, mind you, the ship that Scotty was on was extremely damaged and crashed on a Dyson sphere. But
crashed on the sphere, yeah.
Yeah. But
oh, well. But you would still think a lot. That would take a lot of memory.
Yeah. Yep.
All right. You ready for the next one?
I'm ready.
All right. So the next one is entitled, What's a Cue to You? Written by Morgan Hampton, drawn by Megan Levins, colored by Charlie Kirchhoff. So this is a Q Junior, or as I will always call him, Little Q, story. So Little Q is on a planet. He has a cold. And then we find out that when Qs are sick, things start getting a little weird. Weird in that they are able to transcend the normal planes of existence. So Little Q starts seeing dialogue boxes when his father's talking to him. He starts noticing that someone seems to be watching him from outside the borders of existence. And then you're like, oh my goodness, he's talking about me. So Little Q is very determined to get to me, the reader, and he starts ripping through the book. And as he's ripping through the different layers, he goes from a colored illustration to being an inked illustration to being a pencil drawing and then to even being a blue pencil sketch. Before he can go any further and leave the media world altogether, Father Q shows up and he starts talking some sense into the boy. He says that when Little Q starts to feeling better, he'll no longer see these watchers and he'll actually forget that they are there. Little Q looks at me, the reader, and he vows that since he knows that I'll be watching, he's going to make a very good show. The end.
Okay, there you go. I didn't think this was one of the better ones, but it's fine. When Q Junior or QT or whatever the heck, Little Q, was talking about the observers, I was thinking, there's something bigger than the Qs? And is this like Marvel's Watchers or something? People that watch that don't interfere. And then it's like, oh, he's just gonna break the fourth wall. Okay.
Right. Yeah, at first I thought he was talking about like Trelane's parents. I was like, oh, are they going to actually mention Trelane's parents? And then like, oh, no. Mm-hmm. Nothing like that.
Mm-mm. Yeah, it was. Okay, so there are characters that can get away with breaking the fourth wall, but they're usually quick hits like Deadpool. He does that a lot, but usually it's just for a quick joke and then he's back into the story. This was like, I don't know, but three
whole pages. Oh,
so this was the break in the fourth wall for, a fair amount of the story.
Yeah.
And I didn't find it humorous. So it's like, okay. Hey, what does the... Okay, so the blue pencil is where you write editor's notes, right? Isn't that what a blue
pencil is? Well, it's also where they do like the initial sketches and stuff will often be in that blue pencil because back in the day, I mean, everything's digital now, but back in the day, the blue pencil wouldn't get picked up by the cameras or whatever when they were photocopying it.
There you go. Okay. Well, I knew that because that's what they use the editor's comments for. Mm-hmm. But I had forgotten about the idea that some of the initial rough sketches are done with the blue pencil so it doesn't show up.
Right.
Okay. Okay. Got it.
Yeah, that's why he was losing detail each time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, they've done this before, and I would have almost liked it if Q would have said, yeah, sometimes I can see people like through a pane of glass or something, you know, or like at least make some sort of nod that... Mm-hmm. You know, Q Jr. was trying to get through a comic book where Q himself, when he got sick, maybe he saw people watching him through a TV or something like that. Mm. Or you know, just kind of like acknowledge that comic book's not the only medium that we're going to be watching these guys on.
Right.
So, but yeah, they didn't go there. I don't know. I always like the little occasional break of continuity, especially when you're talking about godlike beings like this. You know, DC's done it, Marvel's done it. It's just don't do it a lot, but every once in a while it's a funny little thing.
Right. Like She-Hulk.
Well, that's a little different because that's a comedy book, or you know, like Deadpool and stuff. They're trying to be funny ongoing, mm-hmm. whereas this is Star Trek's not really a comedy book, so don't do it too often, but once in a while. You know, once in 500 issues is okay to do this like fourth wall breaking thing.
Right.
Yeah. And just I thought Q was a way to do it.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. So like in DC, they've done it where they're like talking about, you know, all the worlds and all the galaxies being or all the multiverse being destroyed or whatever. And then they'll mention like in one universe, somebody's reading a comic book and. Mm-hmm. There is no superheroes in the real world, you know, that kind of thing. And I always find that kind of funny.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, just do it once and then it's over.
Exactly.
Because even Q says they only get sick like once in their whole lives or something like that. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, the whole idea that the Qs would be sick. I mean, aren't they incorporeal? Really?
Right.
And they just take physical form.
Yeah.
When they interact with lower
the physical
life form
thing is a fairly new thing, right? Because I think Q is like the first one to do it. And then it caught on and they did that whole Civil War reenactment thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. It doesn't make sense why he would be having the sniffles and sneezing the whole time.
Right. And annoyingly red in the middle of his face the whole time.
Yeah. That's where he's been rubbing it raw.
Rubbing it raw.
Got the sniffles. All right. Anything else on this issue?
I got nothing. Ready for
the
next one.
I did like that when he pulled the word balloon off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was thinking, all right, I wonder if the letterer is now doing the word balloon that's being slung around or if that's now the artist. So I was trying to like look at the letters. Are they designed different? You know, things like that. So that was just again, that was how I was wasting my time reading this book. And I didn't come up with a conclusion. So
right.
Oh well. All right, you ready for the last comic story?
The biggest one.
I know.
The Lore War kickoff. Okay, let's see it.
All right. Yeah, it's entitled The Final Masterpiece, written by Jackson Lansing and Colin Kelly and Christopher Cantwell, three writers, drawn by David Tinto, colored by Lee Lowridge. So the caption says this takes place after issue 23, but we'll see that may not necessarily be true because... It doesn't quite fit in, but we'll keep going. Lore is having Data draft yet another reality. And he says this one will be perfect because everybody in the universe will be just like him. So we see that every species in the whole galaxy evolves into perfect lore duplicates, both male and female lores. And this is every species, Vulcans, humans, Romulans, amoebas, everything looks like lore. Then lore notices a fatal flaw in his plan. If everything's already perfect, like he is, then there's nothing for him to break. And as we know, all good tyrants want something to destroy. He then rips up this plan, this whole reality, and he tells Data to start over. This time, create it just like the universe before, but to have his name etched into every civilization so that they all know him and they all fear him. And they all know that at any given time, their whole existence can be snuffed out by the all-powerful lore. And he seems happy with what Data's designing, and we get a little teaser for this to be continued in the Lore War, which will come out in 2025. So I glossed over a lot because a lot of it is just like two-page spreads and things like that of what these lore versions look like. But
right.
Ultimately, that was the story. So what'd you think? Did you like this one? Not like it?
I think it was serviceable. I mean, we kind of wonder what was going to go on. I mean, literally, whether lore was going to remake the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And this is... He did! Yeah. So the next gen, so there's a drawing here with the next gen folks, and the Enterprise D is there, right, with a whole bunch of extra crap on it. I've never seen so much crap on the Enterprise D before. Most of which I have no idea what its functionality. Maybe there's a gun or two, and the rest of it I have no idea. And then it showed the actual Enterprise crew, or some of the main characters, and it's like. They looked pretty okay to me, like the real people. I didn't really get the lore face on these next gen folks, or definitely not Riker, maybe because he's got so much hair on his face. I don't know. But then Worf looks like he's really got a little paunch on him, and he's got no chest. So. Anyway, I just thought some of these versions were entertaining.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you really zoom in, I can kind of see that it is Lore's face on all of their bodies. Yeah. But it's just so weird to see Lore's face kind of feminized a little bit and put on Troy's and Crusher's body so that they still look feminine, but they also still kind of look like Lore. It was throwing me off. I mean, it's just like, like it's creepy, but then it also kind of works because, you know, they still have the exact same hairstyle. They still have the same body shape and everything. So it's like, you look at it and you're like, oh, that's Troy. And then if you really zoom in, you're like, nah, it does look a little Lore-ish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So he tries to make everybody look like Lore. And so I guess they've been doing multiple tries at this.
Right, right.
So what? This is the third or fourth, you know, whatever, where they've just stopped and done it all over again. So the idea of Lore getting Data to worry about the details and just, like, dictate is interesting. Of course, in the end, what is Data doing there?
Right, especially the time frame, because this says after issue 23. So what happened at the end of 23?
By the end of 23, Lore set off his explosion of whatever the bomb turned out being. And the Theseus was racing to get away and actually was breaking up at the end of that illustrious issue. False advertising, because it never broke up. But on the Theseus is where Data's head is. So if somehow the Theseus has been safeguarded against the total wipeout and then the remaking and then the wipeout and the remaking because they're in Fluidic Universe or wherever the hell they are.
Right.
Then Data's head is on that ship. It's not where Lore is. The only thing Lore could possibly have is Data's body. And who cares about the body?
Well, here's my theory. We saw in the annual that Lore rips off Data's head, right?
Mm-hmm.
So which makes you at first think that this story must take place before then, and this is just them designing the potential futures, right? Mm-hmm. But then I started thinking about it, and I'm like, well, what if after the annual, and he gets his head ripped off, that Lore is able to create another Data head, or maybe the Data head that's on the Theseus is not really Data's head, you know, or I'm trying
he's supposed
to make
to be
this,
God.
This
he's
issue
supposed to have
makes
the
sense.
Power of God, so maybe he just made a new head.
Or he could have grabbed the data from another universe, and that's the head that they have, right?
Maybe. So, there you go. Okay.
So I don't know. Maybe this is a hint that maybe the data head that's now in the Kelvin universe is not really Data's head. We don't know.
Oh, right. Okay. When you said Kelvin universe, it threw me off for a second. Right. Yeah. they're apparently in the Kelvin universe. Right.
So it'll be interesting to see if they do something like that and they can explain to me why this says after 23, but Data has a full body and head. I'll be okay. But if they don't ever explain that, I'm going to be very upset with this book. Like, that doesn't make sense.
Right.
But I mean, we have seen Data's head taken off and put somewhere for hundreds of years. So Lore could have gone back in time and got the head out of the cave.
Went back to San Francisco.
Yeah. And then we just got to put the head back before the Enterprise D finds it later.
Right.
Time zero. Anyways, you know, with time travel shenanigans, you can do anything.
Anything. Exactly. Okay. Are you ready to talk about the two-page spread?
The two-page spread of the what was inside Lore's mind or whatever? His eyeball?
Well, is that what that is?
Yeah, this is supposed to be his eyeball. Yeah.
Oh, yes. Okay. I kind of see that. Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, let's talk about it because some of these characters I don't get.
I don't
and
either.
And other ones I definitely don't get. They,
yeah, what are they trying to tell us with some of this stuff? Okay, my first question is, all the people in black turtlenecks, are they trying to say that they're dead? Because there's Scotty, who appears to be in fear of his life. He's in mortal fear. B'Elanna looks similar.
Uh-huh.
Her mouth is wide open and she's like screaming or something.
O'Brien. And Geordi, same thing.
Now Geordi doesn't look, he looks disconcerted, but he's not as horror stricken as the other three. But what's the deal?
I don't know.
Dead? What's going on?
They're just high. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know why those four, and they're in the four corners of the eyeball picture.
Mm-hmm.
Total black turtlenecks, look like they're scared or screaming. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Do not know.
Okay. I think Tom Paris looks good in his 2000 Defiance ninja outfit that has brown.
Brown or brown. Yeah, something.
So I'm not quite sure what that's about. Who's the blonde woman?
That's what I was going to ask you. Because it looks just like Chloe from Smallville.
Oh,
that's right above his shoulder. It looks just like her.
Well, that Allison Mack. But why would she be here?
It makes no sense. Yeah, I don't know who she's supposed to be. She has some sort of Starfleet Delta with three dots above it. I don't know if that's supposed to be a hint.
The only woman with short blonde hair in the Star Trek universe, unless you talk about Cass in Voyager, is Tasha.
Is that Cass? Right, and she's over on the right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Tasha's over on the other side. So, you know, that's obviously Tasha. So who is that woman? I don't know.
It could be Cass. Maybe that's who it is. But how would Lore know who Kes is and put it in her in this montage?
I don't know.
And who's the Kai that's next to her?
Well,
is that supposed to be Kira? Is that Kira, the blonde?
Oh, I thought it was Ro. Oh, well, okay. I thought it was Ro, but I guess it could
be. No, I'm saying the blonde girl that we're trying to figure out, is that supposed to be Kira?
With blonde hair?
Yeah.
Maybe. I think a lot of the characters here have been in a recent IDW publication, right?
Right.
So we had, although what is what's his face? What's you doing there?
Oh, that's Hugh. Okay. Yeah. So the Hugh's right above the blonde girl that may be either Chloe or Kes.
Right.
But it's him, like in Picard era, where he doesn't have much of the Borg stuff in him anymore.
Exactly. Okay, so you was in the 2002 book when they went up against the insects.
Yeah, right. Okay, but he was still very Borg. Okay. He was still very Borg.
Okay, fine. Okay, so that makes sense.
And then is that supposed to be the Orion girl above him?
Yes.
But she's white. She's Caucasian.
But she looks human.
Yeah.
Not Orion. Yeah. And why they make Spock a Borg.
Yeah, Spock's a Borg, yeah.
I don't know.
And I do like Shax. That
yeah, what's with the cloth over his head and neck?
Right, I don't know, maybe this will all be explained in the lore war. And we'll be
Maybe it is. Now you'll notice that Sisko and that blonde woman we don't know. They have the same uniform.
Right, with the Starfleet logo and three dots.
Right, and I think it's a pretty cool-looking uniform, quite frankly.
Yeah, it reminds me a lot of like Battlestar Galactica-type uniform.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. Yeah.
And then Spock looks like he's like wearing some sort of superhero outfit with like a big logo on his chest.
Yeah, he does. He looks like that.
Super Borg.
There you go. And then we got Harry in
Alexander.
Yep.
Oh yeah. Oh, Paris, Alexander, Harry, Worf, they're all wearing the same uniform.
Including the Worf sash or whatever you call the what do you call bandolier. The thing that goes across your it's not a bandolier, but yes, bandolier is the closest word I can think of. But there's like a real name for that.
Mm.
I don't know what it is. Anyway, whatever. He's got the thing over his shoulder. And draping down, and all the men folk have that now in this drawing. Anyway, I think it's pretty cool. Oh, wait a minute, hold on. Lore. Let's look at what Lore is wearing.
Oh, he's wearing the same thing or similar.
Kind of, yeah. So, are they somehow Lore's minions? Okay, so all of this is heralding what we're going to see in the lore war. Okay.
Right. We'll have to wait till March.
I'm intrigued. It's a good grabber.
Yeah. So then that last page when it says the lore war will start in March, we got three panels. One shows like a big space battle with a bunch of Federation ships with all that extra bits and stuff that we saw earlier in the issue fighting Klingons. And then the middle panel shows a giant statue of Lore's face with his mouth open, and that's a staircase into a big temple or something like that.
Weird.
And then the last one is Sisko with his head bowed, about to be decapitated by a Batleth.
Hmm. Yeah.
And it looks like a movie screen. It looks like a movie film, so it has the little lines on the side, like a projector film.
Sure.
So I don't know if that's supposed to mean something.
It's just so cinematic. You're supposed to think cinematic. Big fancy stuff. Cinematic.
Yep. Yep. The big crossover.
There you go.
The Avengers of 2025.
Okay.
All right.
Well, we've spent a lot of time. I mean, this is really good and everything, but. Okay. Number eight?
Yeah, it's just a little short essay by Dayton Ward called Star Trek 500, The Continuing Comics Voyages. And Dayton Ward, great author, writes lots of good Star Trek novels. So basically just kind of his little background on how he grew up reading comics, kind of fell out of comics as an adult and then got back into it, and really focusing in on the Star Trek comics from the past, but also hinting to some great Star Trek comics of the future. So I liked it.
Yeah, it was good. And I think we both recognize a little bit of his story, his journey of being a Star Trek comic book fan and a fan in general. I am about 6 years older than Dayton, well, about 5.5 years older than Dayton Ward. But some of the things he talked about resonated with me, and I guess some of it resonated with you too.
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah. He's about 6 or 7 years older than me. So it was just like, his journey was just like mine. It's like, you know, he talks about buying a Gold Key comic first, but I remember buying, you know, Star Trek number one from DC Comics, and that got me hooked. I mean, I was already a fan of the movies, but that really got me hooked into the Star Trek comic book side.
Right. And when he's talking about him in a small drugstore, whatever, in New York, not even knowing that comic book stores were a thing, that's when he was young and seeing some of the Star Trek comic books on a rounder.
Right. And
definitely when I got first into comic books, that was the same thing with me. It was just a drugstore that wasn't all that. It was a bit of a walk to get to it, but that's where I got a lot of my first comic books, at the drugstore.
Oh yeah. No, my first comic book was at like a gas station. It was just on the magazine rack, and it was a Superman book. But then then I started finding out that there was other stuff. And then, yeah, there was a gas station not too far from my house that I would walk to every month to go get the newest Star Treks and Star Trek The Next Generation issues. I remember gas very vividly station. Walking all that way down there just to get the issues and coming back.
Cool.
So, but yeah, and Dayton Ward, just so that you know who he is, he's, you know, he was a huge architect of the post-Nemesis timeline, so that, you know, a lot of those post-Nemesis books were written by him, or he was part of it. And he did one of the Coda books that ended that whole era. So I've really enjoyed most of his books.
Yep.
Or definitely all the books I've read, I've enjoyed.
Right. I've got 6 of his books in audiobook form, and I've listened to 4 of them so far. So that's very cool. The first Coda book, as you mentioned, Pliable Truths, is one I just recently listened to. Very good one. Available Light, Agents of Influence, Headlong Flight, Hearts and Minds.
Yep.
And he's done a lot more than that. That's right. Just ones I happen to have.
Yeah, and I was really surprised that one of his first books was a continuation of that original series episode where they go back in time and beam up that Air Force pilot and then have to return him back to his body. So one of Dayton Ward's first books was a continuation of that. What happened to that pilot?
Pilot?
Once he landed back and had to deal with, does he remember being on a ship or not? You know, that kind of thing.
Right.
I remember really enjoying it. Back when I read it, you know, back when it was new, early 2000s.
Right.
So, yeah. And to be honest, I didn't know that was him until till this morning. Actually, I found out. I was like, hey, wait, he wrote that book. Interesting. I didn't know he went back that far.
Oh, yeah. He's an old guy. But not as old as me.
All right. Well, that was it for this issue. Yeah, anything else?
And a heck of an issue. It's a good issue.
Glad we didn't do 2 stories this
yeah. This is all we needed for an episode. We've gone on too long as it is. But that was good. I enjoyed that. Now, the next one we're going to do is another interesting one.
Yeah, and he even like spells it out in the end of this issue where he's talking about enjoying the 196-page Lower Decks Warp Your Own Way story.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I guess we'll follow his advice and do that next.
Right. So episode 438 is going to be Warping Your Own Way. And exactly how we're going to do this is going to be interesting.
Right. It's a choose your own adventure Lower Decks storyline.
Yeah. We're going to... So we talked about the idea, actually your idea, which is, I think it's a good one, is we each pick our own way. They're going to read it. And then that's what we do the synopsis on. And I will try to be disciplined and keep it short. Because that's going to be 200 pages. So even though you know, your particular path is not going to go over all 200 pages. So yeah. That's going to be a lot of story.
Your path could be quite short.
If you chose it to?
Yeah, not intentionally, but if you make a bad choice pretty early, they kill you off pretty quick, and then you have to start all over. You could come back and be like, yeah, I made one choice and died. That was my synopsis.
So this is like Dragon's Lair.
Yeah.
A video game.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I remember dying a lot in that stupid thing.
But you always liked it because you got to see that cool little death animation of him turning into a skeleton.
Yeah, that was a good game. That was a good game. Okay.
All right. Well, that'll be next episode.
Sounds good. So thanks, everybody, for joining us on the review.
Thank you for listening to Star Trek Comic Book Review. All Star Trek stories and characters are copyrighted CBS Studios Incorporated. All music, stories, and characters discussed are for entertainment purposes only. You can email us at startcomicbookreview@gmail.com. Visit us at our website, www.stcomicbookreview.com. Subscribe to us via iTunes or friend us on Facebook at First Name ST Comic. Second Name Book Review. See you next time on Star Trek Comic Book Review.
Let's get the hell out of here.